blowing snow, especially in the morning, highs 19 to 28, and colder on Saturday with highs near zero. More news is next on KAXE.
It seems like the expiration date of this nearly 50-year-old system is quickly approaching.
In Iran, anti-government protests have been met with violent repression from the authoritarian government. The U.S. is weighing military action.
For Wednesday, January 14th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. A key federal agency abruptly canceled billions of dollars of grants.
That money supported mental health and addiction response efforts.
These are boots-on-the-ground services that people rely on for behavioral health care.
Also, a look at the fight to rein in high prices for prescription drugs.
In examining where we are today, we're pretty much in line with the last, you know, few years.
And Muhammad Ali is being honored with a U.S. commemorative postage stamp.
We speak to the stamp's designer after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. The U.S. and Denmark continue to have what a Danish official calls a fundamental disagreement over Greenland. But NPR's Franco Ordonez reports the two sides are creating a working group to try to reconcile their differences.
Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio met with officials from Denmark and Greenland amid President Trump's ongoing calls to control the Arctic territory. Trump sees Greenland as a national security issue, warning of Russian and Chinese activity in the region. But the Danish foreign minister, Lars Løkke Rasmussen, disagrees.
It is not a true narrative that we have, you know, Chinese warships all around the place. According to our intelligence, we haven't had a Chinese warship in Greenland for a decade or so.
The minister wants the group to focus on addressing U.S. security concerns while respecting the red lines of Denmark. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, the White House.
The Supreme Court ruled today that political candidates can now challenge voting laws ahead of elections. Until now, candidates had to prove they were already harmed by a law before they could sue. NPR's Ashley Lopez reports.
Before this ruling, challenges to election laws brought by candidates wouldn't be taken up by courts until voting had already started, or in many cases, until it was over. In a 7-2 ruling, though, justices argued that requiring proof of harm was forcing many of these challenges to be addressed shortly before Election Day or often after. Some legal experts say this was a correct decision by the High Court that will allow many of these disputes to be resolved in advance of an election. Other legal experts say that this ruling could open the floodgates for candidates challenging rules they don't like, regardless of whether it affects their particular campaign. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
Undocking confirmed. Endeavor begins its journey home with the Crew 11 crew.
The NASA International Space Station crew that includes a sick astronaut is set to return to Earth tomorrow morning. Officials made the decision to end the mission early out of an abundance of caution. They'll return to Earth aboard the SpaceX Dragon Endeavor and are expected to splash down off the coast of California at around 3:41 a.m. Eastern. The National Transportation Safety Board says Boeing warned plane owners in 2011 about a flaw in the part that contributed to the engine flying off a UPS plane before it crashed in November. Boeing said it didn't believe it threatened safety. Three pilots and 12 people on the ground died as a result of the crash in Louisville. The left engine fell off the wing. U.S. overdose deaths fell last year, suggesting a lasting improvement in the epidemic. Overdose deaths have been falling for more than 2 years now. The CDC data estimates 73,000 people died from overdoses in the 12-month period that ended in August 2025. That's down about 21% from the previous year. This is NPR News from Washington. The Senate is heading towards a vote on whether to check President Trump's ability to carry out further attacks on Venezuela. Trump has lashed out at five Republican senators who joined with Democrats to advance the resolution last week. There is growing alarm on Capitol Hill about the president's expanding foreign policy ambitions. French far-right leader Marine Le Pen's future is playing out in a Paris courtroom, with her appeals trial getting underway this week. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports Le Pen was convicted of embezzling public funds last year and barred from holding public office for 5 years.
If she loses her appeal, she'll be unable to run for president in 2027, just as polls show Le Pen and her party largely in the lead. Le Pen was convicted last March of misusing funds from the European Parliament to pay employees working for her party in France. She denies being aware of any wrongdoing. Political scientist Jean-Yves Camus says if Le Pen's conviction is not overturned, she'll likely step aside.
But she wants to be the one who decides how and when she leaves the political scene. She does not want a judge to decide.
Le Pen's young protege, party president Jordan Bardella, will be the party's presidential candidate if she loses her appeal. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
The global music industry hit 5.1 trillion streams in 2025. That's a new single-year record, up 9.6% from 2024. But fewer than half of all U.S. on-demand audio streams were from tracks released in the last 5 years. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. The Buck Lake Improvement Club, 12 miles north of Nashwauk, has a bingo event this Saturday. Doors open at 12:30. Games start at 1 o'clock. Lunch available for purchase. More news is next.
NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. We begin today with a conversation about Iran. Anti-government protests over the last few weeks have been met with violent repression from the authoritarian government. That has left more than 2,500 people dead, according to the U.S.-based Human Rights Activist News Agency. NPR, I'll note, has not been able to independently verify that number. The U.S. is weighing military action in response. When there's big news from Iran, we often reach out to Jason Rezaian. He was the Washington Post correspondent in Tehran in 2014 when he was imprisoned by the Iranian government and later released during the nuclear deal negotiations. He's now the director of Press Freedom Initiatives at the Washington Post, and his op-ed this week is titled, "I've Waited for This Electrifying Moment in Iran for 10 Years." Jason Rezaian, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Juan.
I want to start with this. You've written that for the first time since leaving Iran in 2016, you're now allowing yourself to feel hope that one day you might return. Tell us, what feels different about this moment from moments of protest that you've seen in the past?
I think what we see, Juana, is that the velocity between protest movements in Iran is quickening. If you think back to 2009 and the Green Movement that followed the contested re-election of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, then there were protests in 2017, 18, 19 that were much more regional in scope around economic discontent. Then in 2022, the Woman Life Freedom Movement that was arguably the biggest protest movement in Iran to date, everyone was supporting each other in this very basic demand that we want a freer, more open society where people's rights are protected and guaranteed. And at the same time, we want a better financial future. And I think the regime has not been able to respond to those very clear demands. They don't have a plan to do so. And at this point in time, it seems like the expiration date of this nearly 50-year-old system is quickly approaching.
I want to ask you, Jason, historically, as you see it, where has the U.S. gone wrong when it thinks about change in Iran?
I think we've gotten it wrong for a lot of different reasons. But one of them is that we've rarely followed through on the things that we have promised to do. We talk a lot right now about the internet shutdown and blackout. And it's not just the internet. It's even, you know, landline telephones. And we haven't been able to communicate with anybody inside Iran since a week ago today. Iranians should be able to access the internet. And there are ways to keep people online, right? Congress needs to vote on them. White House needs to put in an executive order around it. And also finding touch points with Iranian civil society. The truth is that there are very few people in Washington or other global capitals that have relevant recent experience inside of Iran. And there are quite a lot of dissidents who have either left Iran in recent years or are still on the ground and willing to communicate their positions. We should be leaning on them to better understand the dynamics inside the country and how we can be most supportive.
Yeah, I want to push on that a little bit. I mean, I've heard you made the argument, and you make it in your piece as well, that the U.S. needs to stop listening to the same voices in Washington and begin to build bridges with people inside Iran. If there is one shift in thinking you would like to see from U.S. policymakers right now, what would that be?
I have always been somebody who's incredibly pro-engagement. I don't think of diplomacy as a weakness. I think of it as a strength, especially when you wield the type of firepower and influence in the world that the United States does. And I think talking to our adversaries is very important. That doesn't mean acquiescing to their demands or giving in to them. And I think, you know, engagement with the Iranian regime right now, especially around the nuclear program, would be a mistake. I think our focus should be centered on the people of Iran and their aspirations. A stable Iran with an open economy and an open society that has the territorial integrity and is in the same borders that we know right now would be in the region's interest and would be in the United States of America's interest.
Jason, this week marks 10 years since you were released from prison. You were forced to leave Iran. When you look at what is happening there right now, how does that anniversary shape how you're taking in and watching this moment?
Juana, it's hard for me to wrap my head around the fact that my wife and I have been out of Iran for 10 years. It's incredibly heartbreaking to me for her that she was very unceremoniously jettisoned and exiled from her homeland and hasn't been able to return and may not be able to do so for the foreseeable future. But for us, at this moment, while we watch the struggle of Iranian people and the fearlessness and the clarity with which they're standing up and demanding a new way forward, and at the same time, the brutal repression of the Islamic regime to kind of silence those demands, it's an incredibly mixed set of emotions. I'm proud. I'm exhilarated, but I'm scared about the loss of life, and also about, you know, the very real possibility that if this regime falls, there's no guarantee that something better would automatically replace it. And I think that that is a very strange thing to say after all of these years. I had hoped and wished we'd be much further along in these conversations 10 years ago than we actually are.
Jason Rezaian is the director of Press Freedom Initiatives at the Washington Post and the paper's former correspondent in Tehran. Jason, thank you.
Thanks, Juana.
The Trump administration sent shockwaves through the country's mental health and addiction response system today. A key federal agency abruptly canceled federal grants that public health experts say amount to about $2 billion. This money supported frontline responders and health programs nationwide. NPR addiction correspondent Brian Mann broke this story and joins us now. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. How did you even learn about these cuts?
Yeah, last night I started getting texts and emails from sources who work on the front lines helping people in severe addiction or with mental health illness. They'd started receiving these termination letters, which are effective immediately, and they came out of the blue. And these people were just voicing devastation. I spoke with Ryan Hampton. He runs one program educating people about how to save lives after a drug overdose. His group was stripped permanently overnight, he says, of roughly $500,000 in grant funding.
We're going to have to scale back and cancel a lot of our overdose prevention work that we do in the state of Nevada and across the country. It's catastrophic for us.
And again, Elsa, it's not just addiction. Mental health groups that support people in independent living do wellness checks. They're also being cut. The U.S. operates with kind of a crazy quilt of nonprofit groups and local agencies grappling with all of these really difficult social challenges. And now I'm hearing from group after group, people saying their budgets have just been blown up. The National Association of County Behavioral Health and Developmental Disability Directors sent a letter to members saying they believe over 2,000 grants nationwide, totaling more than $2 billion in federal funds, are affected. And that $2 billion estimate matches what I'm hearing from other sources.
Wow. Well, has the Trump administration explained why it even is making these cuts?
The agency that sent these letters is the U.S. Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, known as SAMHSA. They're part of the Department of Health and Human Services. We've reached out through multiple channels asking for clarification or details from them, asking why this happened without advance notice. And we've had no answer. NPR has been able to review some of these termination letters, and they all say pretty much the same thing. They say the Trump administration wants to focus on, and I'm quoting here, promoting innovative programs and interventions that address the rising rates of mental illness and substance abuse. They say the programs being defunded are not in alignment with the Trump administration's agenda.
Not in alignment. What does that even mean?
Yeah, in executive orders, President Trump has been making the case that the U.S. needs a new approach to helping people. One example, he wants to scrap support for programs that focus on housing first. That means getting people off the streets into safe housing, even if they're not yet ready to quit using alcohol or drugs. The Trump administration is also pivoting away from programs that focus on harm reduction, things like clean needle exchanges and wound treatment programs that help people avoid the worst health outcomes of drug use. Administration officials have spoken repeatedly about focusing on this kind of treatment and recovery first. But people I've been talking to today say the administration is defunding the old safety net without building this new one first. Andrew Kessler is a consultant who works with mental health and addiction groups nationwide. He thinks a lot of people who are really sick are going to lose help.
These are boots on the ground services that people rely on for behavioral health care. These are sometimes, quite often, really acute conditions. People need help right away. And if you say, come back once we get this sorted out, odds are pretty high that that person's not coming back.
Again, we've asked the Trump administration for comment on these concerns with no response. Programs all over the country scrambling now just to keep their doors open. And I want to say, Elsa, people I've been talking to say many of these programs have been saving lives. One program that distributed free naloxone that helped people reverse fentanyl overdoses. Mm-hmm. Now those programs are going away.
That is NPR's Brian Mann. Thank you so much, Brian.
Thanks, Elsa.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
18 minutes after 5 o'clock. Thanks for listening to KAXC and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 5:30, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can also find local news content and conversations from our morning show at kaxc.org. Support comes from Patterson's Clothing in downtown Bemidji, an apparel retailer serving the Northwood since 1930. Patterson's features clothing from brands such as Cool, Patagonia, Darn Tough, and Smart Wool. Patterson'sClothing.com. We also receive support from the Northwoods Pond Hockey Championship, taking place Saturday, February 14th on McKinney Lake in Grand Rapids, featuring food trucks, live music, and an open skating rink for skaters of all ages. The event is open to all spectators, with more information at northwoodspondhockey.com. Weather for tonight, increasing clouds, lows near 2 below zero. Snow is likely tomorrow. We could see 1 to 3 inches throughout the day. Mostly cloudy, highs 23 to 32. Winds from the south, 10 to 15. And lows tomorrow night near 12, another inch of snow possible. Patchy blowing snow Friday morning with highs 19 to 28. Blustery northwest winds. And getting colder by Saturday with highs near zero. Support comes from the Veteran Mental Health Crisis Response Team of Itasca County. This crisis intervention service is a program of first call for help 211 and provides free crisis assessments, stabilization services, referrals, and resourcing to veterans and their families who are in crisis. Trained providers are available to serve fellow veterans 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by dialing 211. Coming up Saturday, January 24th, KBXE presents Ski Palooza at Three Island Park in Bemidji from noon to 3. Come cross-country ski, snowshoe, fat tire bike, play music, or just swap stories around the fire. You can bring a snack to share. We continue with All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The oil industry has been in the spotlight after the U.S. seized Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro. President Trump met with top oil executives last week, urging them to invest in Venezuela's oil resources. Now, the impact could be mixed for Texas. As Houston Public Media's Natalie Weber reports, the state is home to many oil companies and the most refining capacity in the country.
At a recent protest in Houston, demonstrators criticized the United States' involvement in Venezuela. This is Caleb Karowski, a local organizer.
I think it's very obvious that this is really only about oil.
President Trump has said from the beginning that this operation is, at least in part, about control of Venezuela's oil. Houston is known as the energy capital of the world. But the impacts of U.S. operations in Venezuela could also reach to other parts of the United States, including parts of Texas from the Permian Basin to cities with refineries along the Gulf Coast. The state produced nearly half of the nation's crude oil in 2024 and accounts for about a third of the country's refining capacity. That's according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration under the Department of Energy. This is Texas Oil and Gas Association President Todd Staples.
Immediately, I think Texas refiners can benefit from the existing production because of the heavy crude that's produced in Venezuela that's not produced in Texas.
A few days after Maduro's capture, Venezuela's state-owned oil company confirmed it was negotiating crude oil sales with the U.S. Rice University professor Mark Jones, who studies Latin American politics, says the oil-rich Permian Basin in West Texas could experience a slight negative impact from these exports.
Where the Permian and Texas more generally will be adversely affected is simply if this drives down overall oil prices.
Oil service companies, which manufacture and repair equipment used for oil extraction and transportation, could see a boost from relaxed sanctions on Venezuela. Jones says many of these companies are based in Houston or have a strong presence in the city.
They all have experience working in Venezuela, and they all are very well positioned to return.
The ability of oil companies to invest in Venezuela, Jones says, depends on the country's stability, and many Americans are skeptical of U.S. involvement there.
If you're benefiting the U.S. economy, it's probably to the detriment of someone, potentially Venezuela.
Some Houston-area oil companies have had ties to Venezuela for decades. Chevron is the only major American oil producer still operating there. The company's vice chairman, Mark Nelson, said Friday that the company was prepared to ramp up production. Recently, a judge approved the sale of Houston-based refiner Citgo, which is owned by Venezuela's state-run oil company, to pay off part of the country's debts. International courts have also ordered Venezuela to pay billions of dollars to ConocoPhillips and ExxonMobil. Those remarks later prompted Trump to say he was, quote, inclined to keep the company out of Venezuela. ConocoPhillips CEO Ryan Lance said Friday there will likely need to be conversations about Venezuela's debt and how to finance investments there.
They've already been burned, some of them more than once. You know, they're not going to put good money after bad money.
That's University of Houston Energy Fellow Ed Herz. He compares U.S. operations in Venezuela to interventions in Iraq and Libya.
There's no reason to think that the Trump administration is going to succeed where these others failed.
For now, major oil companies in Texas and beyond remain in conversations with top U.S. officials. For NPR News, I'm Natalie Weber in Houston.
It's the postage stamp that packs a punch. The greatest of all time, Muhammad Ali, lived his life in the boxing ring, was a civil rights activist, and now Ali's American legacy will be forever celebrated with two U.S. postage stamps. Those stamps will be released tomorrow, and the designer of these functional pieces of art is U.S. Postal Service Art Director Antonio Alcala. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you.
Can you just start out by painting a picture? Describe these two stamps for us.
Well, the two stamps feature a portrait. It's a publicity still of Muhammad Ali looking directly at the viewer, holding his hands up with boxing gloves on, looking with a direct gaze in that traditional boxer pose. And it's juxtaposed with very large type of his name, Ali. And inside the eyes of the letter I of Ali is the word the greatest.
I mean, there are so many images of Muhammad Ali, of the countless photos you could have chosen. What did you hope to evoke with this sort of classical boxing poster photo that you picked?
Yes, well, so that's always the challenge when doing a postage stamp. You're going to pick an image that is hopefully iconic and representative of sort of this figure at the peak of their performance, at the height. And so this was Muhammad Ali in 1974, sort of at the zenith of his career. Additionally, you know, Muhammad Ali was quite the entertainer. And so a lot of photos of him where he is making direct eye contact, he's sort of playing to the camera. He can be making a faces or a joke or being playful with somebody who's next to him. So there aren't that many images of him that I could find where he's making that direct eye contact, but that it's also communicating him as a boxer, which was really how he came to be known.
I want to just sort of zoom out big picture here for a second. I am so curious, as an art director, what is at the top of your checklist as you consider how to honor Americans on postage stamps?
You know, we work with a research group, and so if there are holes in my own personal knowledge about the subject matter, they will provide me with additional information, books, websites, et cetera, to do reading and research on. But then it's somehow you try and find an image or a period that'll speak to the public as to why this figure is particularly significant. It's always starting big and then slowly narrowing it down till you find the one piece you think will work best.
The other thing that I find so interesting, right, when you think about these stamps is the fact that we're talking about relatively small real estate to accomplish something so creative and meaningful. How do artists and art directors like yourselves manage to capture the illustration of people, landscapes, and animals with such great detail and then shrink them down so that they will fit on a postage stamp?
As art directors are continually reminding our artists to look at your artwork down at stamp size and or print it out and look at it at actual stamp size. And when you do that, you discover that either there's a lot of detail that becomes lost or elements that you've thought were very clear at full size become sort of hidden and missing. So it's a learning process. It's a real challenge. I came to stamp design sort of later in my career, and it was a real learning curve for me to figure out how to adjust to that constraint of the smaller format.
We've been speaking with Antonio Alcala, art director for the U.S. Postal Service and designer of the new stamp featuring Muhammad Ali. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a few moments, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Weather for tonight, increasing clouds, lows near 2 below. For tomorrow, snow mixed with sleet, up to 1 to 3 inches of accumulation. Mostly cloudy, highs 23 to 32. Lows tomorrow night near 12 with another inch of snow possible. And for Friday, patchy blowing snow before noon, highs 19 to 28 and colder by Saturday, highs near zero.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. The Aiken School District will try for another referendum in April. Voters narrowly rejected two ballot questions in November. This time, the district will split its ask into three. Question one is to build a new pre-K through sixth grade school. Question two is to build a new transportation center. And the third question is to add another gym to the new elementary. The new school and transportation center were combined into a single question in the last election. It failed by about 200 votes. In November, instead of an extra gym, the district asked for a community wellness center. That failed by 440 votes. In total, the district's April ask will be about two-thirds the cost of their last try. Most of Rippleside Elementary is nearing 70 years old. Just addressing immediate maintenance needs would cost upwards of $11 million. At Monday's meeting, school board members noted that taxes will be going up for residents, whether the referendum passes or not.
We're going to have to fund it one way or another, in our one project or another. If it's not a new school, then it's going to either be a full remodel or a full build on the site. A full remodel, or if we're just going to keep kicking the can down the road, it's repairing it.
School districts can take on additional debt without voter approval for certain maintenance projects. Four Republican legislators talked cutting regulation, natural resources, energy, and fraud at the Grand Rapids Area Chamber of Commerce's January 8th lunch with legislators. Representative Roger Scraba of Ely, Representative Spencer Igo of Wabana Township, Representative Ben Davis of Merrifield, and Senator Steve Green of Fauston answered questions from the chamber and two of the 70 or so attendees during the two-hour event. The lunch served as both a recap of last year's session and a preview of what's to come. Each legislator largely stuck to their typical talking points, unlocking critical minerals, lowering government spending, and energy affordability, to name a few. But those can still reveal where the lawmakers' heads are at as they prepare to return to St. Paul. The legislature is set to reconvene February 17th. The session comes at a particularly tense time for Minnesota, with widespread fraud concerns and a massive surge of federal immigration enforcement. It will also be the first time legislators all gather since Speaker Emerita Melissa Hortman was killed last summer. Scraba noted what lawmakers have endured in the last few years feels much different than their predecessors.
There's a lot of things that we still have to do. We can't just get frozen locked up because of all the sideshows that are happening, you know, and unfortunate or fortunate, whatever sideshows they are, but we have to remain focused on representing our districts.
While there was some partisan finger-pointing, Igo and Scraba in particular sought to strike a bipartisan note. With the House split 50-50, votes from both parties are needed for any legislation to pass. Bemidji Mayor George Prince is being nationally recognized for his leadership amid disaster after hurricane-strength winds tore through the city and surrounding area last June. Larissa Donovan has the story.
The straight-line wind event on the night of the summer solstice knocked out power to thousands of residents and damaged hundreds of homes and businesses. Prince says he will accept the award, but on behalf of the entire community.
We know what the aftermath of the storm was for us, how critical and serious it was, how many people were involved, whether that was our emergency service personnel, the lines people that restored power, the United Way, community resource connections, neighbors helping neighbors. And so for me to say I want to stand above all of that is not anything I'm interested in.
The national award is presented by Leaders Link, a nonprofit that harnesses elected officials' disaster lessons to help other communities prepare for and recover from major crises. Prince was nominated for the award by the League of Minnesota Cities, with other nominees leading recoveries from wildfires, floods, tornadoes, and hurricanes. The three-judge panel wrote that Prince, quote, demonstrated exceptional leadership and resilience through the disaster that caused widespread destruction and power outages. Prince says the recovery effort continues to be underway for many Bemidji area businesses and homeowners. Larissa Donovan, KAXE News.
That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive, with small business insurance for protecting a variety of business types with multiple coverage options designed to fit business owners' needs. More about small business insurance is at progressivecommercial.com. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Every January, drug companies typically raise prices for hundreds of brand name drugs. But over the last few years, the Trump and Biden administrations have tried to rein in high drug prices. NPR Pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin is here with more. Hi.
Hi.
So, Sydney, start by telling us how many drug prices went up this year.
Yeah, prices for 872 drugs have increased in the first 2 weeks of 2026, and there could still be more before the month is over. They included drugs that treat cancer, type 2 diabetes, even COVID shots and antibiotics were on the list. That's according to an analysis by 46 Brooklyn, a drug price research firm. Here's Antonio Chacha, 46 Brooklyn's CEO.
January is prime time for list price changes on brand name drugs. So in examining where we are today, we're pretty much in line with the last, few years.
And while those drug price hikes are pretty modest, a median of 4%, they still have an effect on the overall health system. These are list prices, which play a role in which drugs insurers choose to cover and what the patient ultimately pays at the pharmacy counter.
But I thought that the Trump administration was actively trying to lower drug prices. So what's going on here?
Yeah, the Trump administration has been trying to crack down on high drug prices in America and getting other countries to pay their, quote, fair share. The administration calls it most favored nation drug pricing. Since the end of September, 16 companies have made deals in exchange for a break on certain tariffs. The deals vary, but include discounts on some drugs available to people paying cash, that is, not using their health insurance. A new website with those offers called TrumpRx.gov is supposed to launch later this month, but the 46 Brooklyn data show that, in fact, all of those companies have increased at least some of their list prices so far in 2026.
So if I understand correctly, you're saying that some of these companies raised prices even though they made deals with the Trump administration?
Yeah, the deals were short on details and were limited. They mentioned cash prices for some drugs and some vague commitments for Medicaid discounts, something the program already gets. The bigger pledge was for future drugs being launched at the same price here as in other wealthy countries, but that leaves a lot of the company's products untouched. Here's Dr. Ben Rome, a physician and health policy researcher at Brigham and Women's Hospital.
Those deals probably are not very important in terms of manufacturer drug pricing and the prices paid by most Americans for prescription drugs.
So Pfizer, which inked the first Trump administration deal in the fall, raised prices on 72 products, according to 46 Brooklyn. They include a 15% increase on the price of its COVID shot.
And what does Pfizer say about that?
Yeah, Pfizer says its price increases were modest and necessary to invest in new medicines and address added costs. In an email to NPR, Pfizer also pointed out that while list prices have gone up, the prices insurance companies pay them have gone down because of bigger rebates and discounts. I asked the Trump administration about the January price increases, and the White House told me list prices don't really matter.
Okay, Sydney, we've talked about increases, but were there any decreases?
There were. There were 18 big price cuts in the first few days of the year, including paying for drugs that were part of Medicare drug price negotiation, which was actually a Biden administration initiative. The negotiations lowered prices for Medicare, and a big question was whether that would affect prices for everyone else. Now, we see that it was likely at least a factor in lowering prices in the commercial market. Fiasp and insulin got a 75% price cut. Farxiga and Jardiance, both for diabetes and heart failure, and the blood thinner Eliquis also got big price drops. But I should add that these are decisions that companies make based on a variety of factors and policies.
NPR Pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin, thank you.
You bet.
It has been a tumultuous and occasionally violent week for anti-ICE protesters in the Twin Cities. Federal immigration officers have arrested some of these protesters and tackled or tear-gassed others. Last month, the ACLU sued on behalf of protesters and observers. The group says the agents are violating the free speech rights of peaceful demonstrators. Now, the federal government says that it's simply trying to keep unruly crowds from obstructing lawful immigration enforcement. NPR's Martin Kasi joins us now to talk about the fight over free speech during a crackdown. Hi, Martin.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so let's start with this ACLU lawsuit. What exactly are Minnesota protesters alleging there?
The lead plaintiff in that case, Susan Tincher, gives this story. She says that in December, she got an alert about ICE activity in her neighborhood there in Minneapolis. She went there and she asked an officer, "Are you ICE?" And she was told to get back. And the lawsuit says that in just a few seconds, agents pushed her to the ground, cuffed her, and took her to a federal building. And she was later released without being charged. So the lawsuit says that's a part of a pattern. Agents apparently retaliating against people for exercising their constitutional rights to observe them, to ask questions, and take video of these operations.
Okay, well, since that happened in December, reports of these kinds of incidents have increased dramatically this year, right? Yeah. Like, especially after an ICE officer shot and killed Renee Macklin Good in Minneapolis last week. Where does this lawsuit stand at the moment?
They're trying to get the federal judge, Catherine Menendez, to issue a restraining order this week, if they can, against certain federal tactics. In a hearing yesterday, the attorneys representing the plaintiff said they want an order that would stop actions such as arresting or threatening to arrest people who are lawfully protesting or watching federal agents, as well as pulling over the cars that are following them. And the lawyers for the government say that the agents are just taking appropriate actions when facing what they deem to be hostile crowds.
Is that illegal, though, following ICE officers around or observing them or recording them?
Traditionally, that has not been considered illegal, per se. Mm-hmm. On the question of tailing officers, though, I did talk to Jim Bierman, who's a former chief of police in California, now the president of a think tank called Future Policing Institute. And he says officers do have a legitimate need to find out they're being followed.
Probably 90% of the time, it's just going to be these monitors who mean them no harm. But there are instances in this country's history of police officers being ambushed. There's going to be somebody, someplace, sometime who's probably going to ambush some of these ICE agents or do something violent toward them.
But he says that doesn't mean they should arrest people. Bierman says that as a police chief, he would tell his officers to talk to the person following them, see if the person is a threat. If he's not, let that person keep following and wait for him to get tired and stop.
Okay, well, let's talk about the federal government's justification here. They say these agents are simply pushing back against people who are impeding law enforcement. Do they have a point there?
Well, civil rights experts think that the Trump administration is trying to broaden the definition of what the law about impeding says to include things like following agents or coordinating protests, maybe. And they point to a recent memo from the Attorney General's office, which categorizes impeding federal officers under a larger strategy for combating domestic terrorism. Now, usually impeding means materially obstructing, blocking officers physically, or concealing a person that they're seeking. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you break the law, if you put your hands on an officer or ignore a lawful order to disperse.
Sure.
But now we're seeing videos from around the country of ICE officers just telling motorists that they'll be arrested for following them. And if you add that to this memo about domestic terrorism, there's a sense that maybe there's going to be some new situations and some new charges that people might face.
That is NPR's Martin Kasi, who covers law enforcement. Thank you so much, Martin.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered. How does a democratic country hold its elected president accountable for a power grab? South Korea provides one example. This week, Korean prosecutors recommended the death penalty for its ex-president in connection with his attempt to declare martial law in December of 2024. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Seoul on the country's efforts to fortify its democracy.
A court in Seoul held its final hearing this week for Yoon Song-yeol on charges of insurrection. Assistant Special Counsel Park Ok-soo summed up the evidence of how Yoon tried to crack down on people who could limit his power. Yoon's martial law decree limited citizens' political rights, Park said, and he sent soldiers and police to seize control of parliament.
The shock and anxiety it caused to the people and the nation was indescribable.
But soldiers balked at their orders. Protesters took to the streets and lawmakers voted down Yoon's decree within hours. Still, the crisis shook the world's trust in South Korea as a stable democracy. Park said that the court's sentence needs to deter future power grabs.
The people hope for a strong punishment and expect and trust that the courts, the last bastion of justice, will fulfill that role.
He added that Yoon has shown no remorse.
Therefore, I request that you sentence the defendant to death.
Yoon told the court that he just wanted to send a wake-up call to citizens that opposition lawmakers were paralyzing the government. So, rather than undermining democracy, he argued, he was protecting it.
I implore you to consider the grave responsibility I bore as the president to prevent constitutional collapse and governmental paralysis during a national crisis. This can never constitute subversion of the Constitution.
The progressive administration of President Lee Jae-myung that followed Yoon has suggested reforms to check presidential powers, such as restricting presidents to 2 4-year terms instead of the current single 5-year one, and tightening up the country's Martial Law Act. But Shin Jin-uk, a professor of sociology at Jong-un University in Seoul, says that may not be enough.
Reforms in the right direction don't automatically mean the system will protect democracy. In politics, an overwhelming bipartisan majority that respects democratic and constitutional norms and values is important.
Shin notes that many conservative opposition politicians still think Yoon's martial law bid was justified. He adds that many South Koreans aren't sure that if there's another power grab, big powers including the U.S. will stand up for democracy or just use the crisis for their own political aims.
Many Koreans think the latter possibility can't be ruled out. They think that in this era, Koreans will be left to protect their democracy and human rights on their own.
A verdict in Yoon's insurrection trial is expected next month. South Korea hasn't executed anyone for nearly 3 decades, so even if Yoon gets the death penalty, it'll probably be commuted to life in prison. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. 7 o'clock, Dave the Wave, your volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. Support comes from Bemidji Brewing, located at 211 America Avenue in downtown Bemidji. Their new year starts with beer infusions and events such as Tropical Escape Week, featuring live music and tiki glassware. More at bemidjibeer.com. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. We also thank the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, dedicated to conserving the rich ecological landscape of Minnesota, offering memberships, educational camps, and habitat projects. More information at mndeerhunters.com. Increasing clouds tonight, lows near 2 below, and for tomorrow, snow possibly mixed with sleet, 1 to 3 inches of accumulation, mostly cloudy, highs 23 to 32, winds from the south 10 to 15, lows tomorrow night near 12, another inch of snow possible, and for Friday, patchy blowing snow, especially in the morning, highs 19 to 28, and blustery northwest winds, colder by Saturday with highs near zero. The Winter Lecture Series continues at the Forest History Center in Grand Rapids this Saturday, 1 o'clock. Author Pete Carroll will talk about innovations in mine land management that have led to ecological restoration. And Chair has a free community meal this Sunday at their location on Chestnut Street in downtown Virginia from noon to 3. They'll also offer food and clothing distribution to those in need. If you have items to donate, you may bring them to Chair at any time. You can look for events up north at our website for a list of more events happening across northern Minnesota this week. And if you have events to share with our listeners, you can send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. There's more ahead from All Things Considered.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. If you've heard music from the hit show Orange is the New Black, you've heard the work of husband and wife TV composers Brandon Jay and Gwendolyn Sanford.
Last year, they were among the many who lost their homes in the Palisades and Eaton Canyon fires that ripped through the greater Los Angeles area.
We managed to save my wife's acoustic guitar and one of my electric guitars.
But Brandon Jay says they sadly lost hundreds of other instruments. And it made him think about other musicians in the area, which brings us to this week's edition of Here to Help, our series focused on service and community.
A week after the fire, I did a Facebook post talking about the value of instruments, and I mentioned just a handful of instruments that were special to us that we lost. I talked about them in that, like, the value of instruments isn't necessarily the monetary value, but it's like the sentimental and the emotional value that you have attached to them and the stories behind them that make them special, and that I wanted to replace them with ones that I got from friends.
A week later, Jay and his wife played a local community event in Pasadena. Friends, acquaintances, and even people he hadn't seen in years showed up with instruments, some of them identical to the ones they'd lost in the fire.
That event would give Jay the idea to launch several projects to give back to the musical community. First, there's Altadena Musicians, a registry for artists to sign up for help replacing their lost gear and to exchange stories.
And then just kind of snowballed from there. And we got a website up and running pretty quickly at the end of January. And so people would reach out and, like, share these stories of what they lost.
The organization also created an app that helps streamline the instrument donation process and a free record store where music lovers can begin to replace record collections that may have been lost in fires too, which Jay says can feel like a bigger hit than losing instruments.
Because it's something that you collect over, like, your whole lifetime. And, like, you start when you're young with your first album that you saved up for, or you got for Christmas or whatever. And you remember those, all the memories. And so many people lost that. They lost that lifelong thing. And we can just keep this going and start to, like, help people start to replace their instruments and their record collections and just be like this musical hub for the community, for people to get together and see each other and stay connected.
Altadena Musicians has also raised enough money to launch a physical space for live music performances, rehearsals, recording, and instrument repairs.
Brandon Jay says even though it's been a year since the fires, he hopes this effort can help artists who are coping with their losses for a long time to come.
I just wanted to be like an ongoing situation because for so many people, they're not ready yet. Like, I'm not ready yet to have everything that I lost. Like, they have limited space where they are, or they're just, like, emotionally not ready. And then, like, a couple years from now, when they are ready, I wanted it to be available to them so that they wouldn't have to worry about that expense.
For more stories about volunteerism, check out npr.org/here to help.
Every year, there is a big concert here in Washington, D.C., celebrating the life of Martin Luther King Jr. It's called Let Freedom Ring. It's featured Aretha Franklin, Gladys Knight, and Leslie Odom. Common is performing this year. It has been a signature event at the Kennedy Center for more than 20 years. This year, it'll be at a different venue. NPR's Elizabeth Blair has more.
Let Freedom Ring was initiated by Georgetown University in 2003. The choir is made up of singers from the school and gospel groups in the D.C. region. Last year, one of the headliners was Esperanza Spalding.
Esperanza Spalding, please don't tell her, but man, that is my celebrity crush.
Mark Bamuti Joseph was the Kennedy Center's Artistic Director for Social Impact, a division that created programs for underserved communities in the D.C. region. He was one of the speakers at last year's Let Freedom Ring, which was held on the same day as President Trump's inauguration to his second term.
Y'all have been very cordial, I have to say, and that is not in the radical spirit of the man that we are here to celebrate. So I'd appreciate it if y'all acted like y'all knew.
Everyone in the audience was very well aware of the sobriety that came with having this celebration on the same day as the inauguration of the 47th president. And so we needed in that moment a little bit of permission to access joy.
1 month after Let Freedom Ring, Trump took over the Kennedy Center and appointed new leadership, and shortly after dissolved the Social Impact Division. Bamuti and his team were laid off. For the first time since 2003, Let Freedom Ring will not take place at the Kennedy Center. Georgetown University says it's changing the venue to save money. But Bamuti thinks it wouldn't have been appropriate to celebrate King at the Kennedy Center right now.
I would much rather that we all be spared the hypocrisy of celebrating a man who not only fought for justice, but who articulated the case for equity maybe better than anyone in American history, when the official position of this administration is an anti-equity position.
The Let Freedom Ring celebration became a signature event for the Kennedy Center. Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama both attended the event. Composer Nolan Williams Jr. has been the event's music producer since 2004.
You celebrate the time that was and the impact that has been and can never be erased, and then you move forward to the next thing.
This year, Williams wrote a piece for the event called Just Like Selma, inspired by one of King's most famous quotes. The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice.
There is an arc, a moral compass, charting freedom's wax and wane. Sometimes we're startled how that arc allows some things hard to explain.
Williams says sometimes the quote is interpreted in a passive way.
The arc doesn't just happen to move. We have to be agents of change. We have to be active arc movers, arc benders. And so throughout the song, you hear like these action words like protest, resist, endure, agitate, fight hate. And those are all the action words that remind us of the responsibility that we have to be arc benders.
This year's Let Freedom Ring will be held at the historic Howard Theater. The rapper and actor Common will join choirs made up of singers from Georgetown University and D.C. area churches. The Kennedy Center announced this week that its celebration of Martin Luther King Jr. Day will feature the Missionary Kings of Harmony. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. And from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
It's just before 6 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thanks so much for your support. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. Increasing clouds tonight, lows near 2 below. For tomorrow, snow possibly mixed with sleet, 1 to 3 inches, highs 23 to 32. Winds from the south, 10 to 15. Lows tomorrow night near 12 with another